Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, almost hour. Tuesday afternoons mean that Father Thomas Loya will be with us, and we'll be talking about theology of the body, and also this historic meeting that I think we saw happen, but we still don't really maybe appreciate the implications, and the East meets West with the meeting of Pope Francis and the Patriarch Kirill in Cuba, of course, of Russia. We'll talk with Father Thomas, being a Byzantine Catholic, his perspective on this East meets West meeting, and talk all about that with him here in just a moment. So that's coming up. Also, a little bit more as we see the development after Justin Antonin Scalia's passing. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. We know that this is an additional time of political wrangling and potential backfiring, I think, anytime we look at something of this nature. But Reuters has an interesting perspective. We'll talk about that as well. And then I popped over to my Twitter feed just to see what was happening over there, and I found this from Wired. I doubt if we'll have time to talk about it, but it looks pretty cool. The go-kart that has been introduced, which our oldest son has been asking for one. Maybe it's time for his dad to get one first. So pretty cool, the smart go-kart. Maybe we'll talk about that. More to come. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, almost hour. Back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Minutes every afternoon, culture, current events, our Catholic faith, and hopefully we're going to be talking to Father Thomas Loya in just a moment. A little bit of connection issue there on the break, which happens, and we should have him back here in just a second. So we'll look forward to that. Follow me on Facebook, Leo C. Brown. You'll find many things that we talk about on the show and some things that we don't have time to talk about, but nonetheless, I post many things over there. A lot of talk about gun control. We're going to get into this later on. From what I gather, the first that we've heard of the guys with the Eagles of Death Metal, Jesse Hughes, who basically has some very interesting things to say when it comes to gun control, and having had the experience that he has had being there, seeing this happen as he did, I think he's kind of got a perspective that is unique in and of itself. Are we not getting Father?
He's not replying. All right.
I think he's trying to call back in on Skype. So, and this is, I think, undoubtedly a touchy subject. We know that. I don't think that we have an expert perspective that says this is how this undoubtedly solves every problem. There's nothing that says we can guarantee a fix, right? I think in any of this, it really comes down to are we actually going in the right direction or the wrong direction? And we certainly see in his perspective, and this is Rolling Stone, by the way, that has this article, he's saying that he thinks, based on what he saw, and granted, he was a gun proponent even before this happening, but his perspective is this could have been avoided had more people been armed, right? So, yeah, hindsight is always 20/20. you really not, you don't know how to best address this. We're not sure, but this is something that he certainly seems to think is the case. So I think we're still trying to get connected from what I gather. Okay. Maybe we can try to get the phone call in. We'll see what's going on. Having some connection issues this afternoon, which unfortunately happens in the world of live media, that anything can happen. So, again, as he does at least have a perspective, again, I'm talking about Jesse Hughes, the member of the band Eagles of Death Metal, in his interview on French media, basically asking the question, did the strict gun control laws that Paris has do anything in this situation? And this certainly is cause for a consideration of what we're talking about. Yeah, can we make it tougher for individuals to get their hands on things of this nature? We can, right? We can enact legislation that would create a higher wall of protection around someone doing something with a legal purchase, but then what do you do with those that aren't? And certainly in a case like we saw with this terrorist activity in France, how do you stem that with legislation, right? You don't typically stem illegal activity legislatively, unfortunately. So we may get back into this and revisit a little bit later. I think we do have Father with us at this point. Father Loya, how are you?
Okay, Leo. I'm not sure what's going on with the Skype hookup. But
well, things happen.
Yeah.
We got you now, so all is good. So welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Very good.
We wanted to unpack this a little bit because we talked about this last week, certainly on the show when we saw this occur, but I think there's a lot of interesting implications when you look at this East meets West meeting with Pope Francis and the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill. So you're in an interesting perspective as a Byzantine Catholic because you kind of see both sides of this thing, right?
Yes, we do. For the sake of the audience, a Byzantine Catholic and an Eastern Catholic are really those portions of the Orthodox churches that reunited with Rome starting in about the 15th and 16th centuries, and because there was a great split between the two in 1054 AD. Think of it like a marriage, you know. It was a relatively happy marriage for about 1,000 years, and they had a divorce. One side called itself the Orthodox, the other side became known as the Roman Catholic Church. Well, about 500 years later, as a result of a couple of councils like the Council of Florence and the Council of Lyons, these were attempts at reunion over the centuries after the split. It results of some of that influence and other factors put together, parts of these Orthodox churches began to reunite with Rome again. And that's what we have, that's what we know today as the Eastern Catholic Churches, which is, of course, what I am. Mm-hmm. There's a number of different rites of the Catholic Church. Most of them are Eastern Catholic. So I'm a Byzantine Catholic. That's one of the Eastern rites. Now, what's really interesting about that, though, for this this topic is that the Eastern Catholic Churches are, well, ideally they're supposed to be seen as a bridge to between the two, Orthodox and the Roman Catholic. And we can be and ought to be, and I think that we are when we're at our best selves, but at the same time, we're a major obstacle. In fact, one of the major obstacles, because the Orthodox believe that we kind of, it's kind of like think of it this way, it's like when one of your children sneaks out at night and goes and lives with the neighbors or something.
Right.
They kind of feel that was, and they also feel that Rome kind of enticed us to do that.
Wow.
They call that proselytizing, which
right.
they still accuse Rome of doing at times, especially in Russia.
So you guys are kind of turncoats to them. You've kind of
been
like a traitor.
Yeah, we're like turncoats. And then we say, well, we're just reunited with Rome the way it was in the beginning, you know, the way it always was. You know?
Right.
And we didn't really see ourselves as breaking from our Orthodox, you know, we didn't see ourselves as moving out of one house into the other.
Right.
We kind of saw ourselves as sort of, you know, I don't know, hanging out the window of one and reaching over into the other. Something like that, you know.
Right.
And, but they see it as, oh, no, you guys betrayed us. You left out, you left us and stinked out at night, you know. And the Eastern Catholic churches then are a big subject for discussion here and for division, especially on the part of the Orthodox. And what they did was, and this goes back to 1993, actually, Leo. That it's in Balaman, Lebanon. They call it the Balaman Statement between very, very high level ecumenical commissions. They, in dialoguing with each other, the Orthodox and the Catholics, they came to the conclusion that the agreement that the Church, the Roman Catholic Church, would no longer enter into reunion with any other Eastern Church unless it was the whole Church. Mm. Like, for instance, in this case, it'd be like if this Russian Orthodox patriarch came to Pope Francis last week and said, okay, I'm bringing my whole Church with me, and I'm reuniting with you. If they did that, then both sides agreed, okay, that's a good way to do it. That's what we'll go with. But we're not going to do it piecemeal. In other words, if part of your church comes over to us, we won't accept them. Hmm. It has to be your whole church with you, the patriarch. So they made that agreement, and they also made the agreement that the Eastern Catholic churches that exist now have the right to exist and to work on our own destinies, because, you know, the Orthodox tonight, up to about that point, you know, some of them believe that we didn't even have the right to exist, you know, mm-hmm. unless we were like annihilated. Rome just totally disowned us. They wouldn't have anything to do with Rome. But at that agreement back in 93, they softened a bit of compromise and said, okay, all right, they're here, they exist, they have a right to exist, but no more of this style. And they ratified that same statement last week between the patriarch and the Pope. So, see, because the thing is, people have to understand that, and I met all these people last year, I met Cardinal Koch, talked with him personally, met the Pope, talked with him personally, and Bartholomew. In fact, we preceded the Pope's visit to Patriarch Bartholomew last year. We saw him first, and then we went right on to go see the patriarch, and in fact, the Pope says, well, give him my greetings. I'm going to see him pretty soon. He actually said that to us.
Oh, fun.
So we brought greetings from the Pope to the patriarch.
Wow.
And anyway, in those discussions with them, and they were very frank discussions. I was very impressed. Cardinal Koch is the Pope's representative for all this ecumenical work. And they were very frank about us, about the Eastern Catholic Churches and the Orthodox. And you know, Rome is very, 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 very interested in, very eager to improve these relations with the Orthodox Church, ultimately get them, hopefully, you know, work towards, you know, reunion, complete mm-hmm. reunion. And the Eastern Catholic Churches, though, some of them, especially the Ukrainian Eastern Catholic Churches, it's a Byzantine church as well, they're kind of sitting a little bit on pins and needles because they don't want to be sold out. You know, there's a whole lot of, there's a whole other level of politics going on here, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
because especially in Russia, and a lot of these Eastern churches and cultures, it isn't like here, Leo. You know, there's a lot more intermingling of culture, government, and church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Russian Orthodox Church has been very much under the thumb, really, of the Russian government, and they were infiltrated by communists during those years. And so they speak from the standpoint of the church, but also it kind of overlaps into the government and into Putin. Patriarch Kirill is Putin's spiritual advisor.
Right.
And so, and the big issue there, of course, is Putin cutting off pieces of Ukraine, you know, like mm-hmm. Crimea and mm-hmm. something like that.
Sure.
And so the question among the Ukrainian Byzantine Catholics is that, well, is Rome going to, you know, they're going to say something about that?
Mm.
Or are they going to be afraid to compromise progress with reunion? So there's a lot of...
Wow.
It's a very complex, multi-layered political thing on top of the theological, you know, mm-hmm. the spiritual.
Yeah. And 1,000-plus years to boot, right? I mean, we got all of that to got to contend with as well. So we'll talk more about this in just a moment. Father Thomas Loya is with us this afternoon, and taperlife.org is his website. You can find out more about that, talking about this historic meeting between the Russian Orthodox Patriarch and Pope Francis. Back with more in just a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, almost hour. Tuesday afternoons, we are joined by Father Thomas Loya, TaborLife.org. You can find out more about what he does there. Father, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Good to be back.
We're talking about this historic meeting of the Patriarch Kirill of the Russian Orthodox Church and Pope Francis that happened last week in Cuba. And the interesting, you know, as I joked before the break, there's 1,000 years of stuff, but there's a lot of stuff that is really baggage in this. And you mentioned earlier, I find it very interesting that I didn't know this until you discussed it, Father, that the Eastern Rite Catholic churches, those that are in communion with Rome, are looked at disdainfully like you guys have jumped ship. And, you know, I think that that's an interesting dynamic as well, because the Orthodox Church would claim that they were the original church, whereas the Catholic Church claims that they're the original church. So, you know, how do you determine that? Yeah, how do you even start? Starting there is difficult, right?
Well, I think it's St. John Paul II's term about the church breathing with both lungs.
Mm-hmm.
They both were the original church, just the Eastern expression and the Western expression. I guess you could say the East was, a little bit more ancient in the sense that the church started there, of course, in the Middle East, which
right.
we call the East. But, let's face it, St. Paul, Peter, went to Rome.
Right,
I mean,
sure.
It immediately went west, And it developed, perhaps the ancient rites, liturgical rites as rites and stuff like that, developed a little bit sooner in the East.
Right.
But, you're talking about, really relatively the same time. So they're both equally ancient, and they both are equal dignity. But what happened was those churches that were of the Eastern expression, and they had patriarchs, which were almost like, that's maybe a bad analogy, but I'll use it anyway, mini popes. In other words, they had their heads, head of their particular churches, and it's so the Orthodox believe that those people that were under those heads, those patriarchs, belonged to them,
mm-hmm.
but that some of them, scooted out from underneath them and joined Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be the Eastern Catholic churches.
Right.
Both churches are original,
right.
And they both, two lungs breathing. It's like, which one of your lungs is more original? Mm-hmm. Well, they both are, it's just that the Eastern churches say that when these groups left the Orthodox Church, or they say they left them, reunited with Rome, that was the kind of like the betrayal. But you see, the thing is, the Eastern churches that did that, when that happened, they didn't think of it as leaving their Eastern churches,
mm-hmm.
Their patriarch. They just said, thought of it as reuniting with Rome. And one of the reasons they did that happened, and certainly this was a case in my church, it came from the Central Europe, Eastern Europe, is Islam had overrun Constantinople, mm-hmm. And later then Istanbul,
right.
Overran it. The place of the patriarch was really diminished. The Eastern Orthodox patriarch in Istanbul, and my people, my ancestors were under that patriarch. Where there was a disconnect, there was a disconnect there, and the churches began to go into a little bit of a disarray or kind of a decay.
Hmm.
And then what happened was Rome at the time was much stronger. The Roman Catholic Church was much more solidified and stronger, and they bordered where my church was, and that Central Europe is like the epicenter, the meeting point of the Eastern and Western churches, actually, in Europe. And so they made the overture. They said, well, why don't you guys join up with us? And we looked at them and said, you got a little more order right now. We're in a bit of chaos. The Muslims have overran our head. We don't hear from them at all.
Wow.
We don't get any help from him. So it was to their advantage to reunite.
Hmm.
But also, there were a couple over the centuries before, as I mentioned, there were a couple of councils that were dedicated to reunion. In fact, the Council of Florence, there actually was an agreement of reunion.
Oh, wow.
But what happened was, when the leaders who came home from the council, all in agreement with each other, when they took that agreement to their rank and file, that's when it fell apart.
Right.
They didn't trust it, and so it broke apart.
Hmm.
But the residue of that still remained. So the reunion of these Eastern Catholic churches was a combination of things, overtures to Rome to say, hey, why don't you guys come here, and we were looking for help, too. And also the residue of these councils that really try to make progress for reunion.
Mm-hmm. But there was, until 1054, the Bishop of Rome was then over, had authority over the Eastern Church as well?
No, not authority. He was first among equals. He had a place of primary place, but not authority. In other words, he was sort of like a tiebreaker.
Right.
You know, he was the one they appealed to. And in fact, during the Crusades and so like that, many times the East appealed to Rome for help. Even during the councils, some of the early councils of the Church, and they were called by the Pope. The Pope helped to decide certain things. So Rome was always a place of recourse for the East. And to this very day, even the hardest-lined Orthodox will admit, and they have to admit, otherwise you're denying history, they will admit and have to admit that the Pope of Rome does have a place where we can say maybe he's first among equals. They know that there's something special about the Pope of Rome.
Wow.
The fight happens when you try to decide, okay, what does it exactly mean in the lived, ministerial, jurisdictional realm? In other words, how much power does he have over everybody else? That's the part that where they go to battle. But his place of primacy in terms of being kind of first among equals or having a special place, a place of recourse, yes, even the hardline Orthodox will admit that. They have to, because that's been their tradition as well. You can see it even in the history of the Eastern churches.
So then in 1054, when the split happened, what exactly was the issue that drove the wedge?
There wasn't any one issue. It was kind of it's almost like, just like in a marriage, that's why I like to use the term divorce, Leo, because just like in a divorce, there's a gradual kind of an alienation happening over time, fights, things like that. Well, there was a kind of a gradual disagreements were happening all along for quite some time. As the two churches developed their own identities, see, then they began to see, well, you're a little bit different than me. Well, you must be wrong. No, you're wrong. Wow. It was like that. And that crescendoed to the point where they just excommunicate each other. And in fact, if two prelates in either side, East and West, would have counted to 10 before they acted, we'd probably still be in reunion again.
Wow.
Really, really, I mean that. You know, and but it was things like the filioque and how we go to communion, you know, the leavened bread versus the non-leavened bread, and the communion of both species. Filioque was a big one. The universal jurisdiction of the Pope, they thought, again, it's still a issue that they thought that the Pope of Rome was exercising too much power jurisdictionally, you know, like being too much of a ruler, rather than just having a place of primary place among the other, you know, first among equals.
Right.
So there were a number of issues, and most of those issues today they're not as relevant in this discussion. The two most relevant issues are the primacy of the Pope, in other words, in his universal jurisdiction, and the Eastern Catholic Churches. Those are the two biggest issues that divide us right now.
Well, Father Thomas Loy is with us this afternoon, taperlife.org. Find out more about him there. And we're talking about this historic meeting between East and West with Pope Francis and Patriarch Kirill last week in Cuba. And the one thing that I've heard time and time again is that this day and age, if we were to look at the challenges that were there for the Protestant Reformation, right, that really it's non-existent if you consider where we are today compared to where we were then. The problems really were somewhat isolated, and they weren't quite as universal as it seemed, and now we've gotten beyond that. I guess the question would be, you say it's not quite as prominent as it was then. Are we at a point now where we could say, look, we could unify, and we don't have to worry about those areas of division because we could at least have some allegiance and collegiality with one another. Is that something that could happen?
Well, it's interesting you bring it up, Leo, because that's actually one of the cutting-edge kind of cutting-edge things that they're working on in a lot of these high-level dialogues between Orthodox and Roman Catholics. They're looking at, well, maybe just as you said, maybe there's ways we can actually start doing things together, and then that would kind of move us gradually towards full communion. See, the question is, it all surrounds the idea of communion. Are we in communion with each other? In other words, do we receive Holy Communion from each other? Are we in one body of Christ? Are we broken from each other? And I believe that we are moving very close to the point where we can say, look, we do have some differences to work out, but does that really preclude us from receiving communion from each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, from being in communion with each
True
other.
Communion. Yeah. Well, yeah. The one thing I think that Pope Francis would likely exhibit, hey, if it means me being last among equals, that's okay. You know what I mean? I think he would probably bring that to the table and say, oh, what is it? What is it we need to work on here? And, you know, I mean, and if that means him being seen as a patriarch by them, so be it, right? I mean, if it means that we could unify and really be on the same page when it comes to breathing with both of those lungs, as St. John Paul II suggested.
Yeah, he would, and Pope Benedict made a lot of progress in that regard as well,
right.
Because he said, we can't expect the Orthodox to adhere to anything that did not happen in the second millennium of Christianity, because it was after we broke, and we continued to develop our own kind of identities and deal with our own problems like that. And he says, the Orthodox didn't have the same history as we did after the first millennium. So Benedict was very much in looking at the papacy back in terms of the first millennium, because it grew to the point it is today, largely because of historical circumstances in the second millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And these historical circumstances did not exist in the East. They didn't have the same challenges. They had challenges, but different ones. And the ones that the West had kind of propelled, like a plant, you know, like it added water to the plant, and the plant grew, you know, the papacy grew because of the situations, especially Protestantism and the other challenges of the church.
Father, we're out of time, but God bless you. We'll talk next week. Thank you so much. More to come in just a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. 50 minutes every afternoon. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith. A big current event that is certainly culturally oriented. May not necessarily be faith related, but I think as people of faith, we have a definite dog in this hunt when it comes to exactly what's going to happen in this replacement of Justin Antonin Scalia. And we keep seeing this just kind of just in the past few days, as quickly as this has been, I mean, his funeral is not even concluded, and this has become just a massive issue of what happens next. And we know that the Senate Republicans are basically saying, hey, the president can name a nominee all day long, and they would not confirm this nomination until after the election. And in hopes then that there would be an appropriate, for Republican expediency, an appropriate candidate named that would be this nominee. And the question really is that a wise move given the fact that this is an election year? Because there's hope, of course, on the side of the Senate Republicans that they maintain the majority. But the other question is, by doing this, does this set a tone for the moderate majority, which can swing an election and has and will swing this election, right? That's how this election will be determined. It's not by the bases. The bases on both sides of the political spectrum are always going to be the base. It's the moderate majority of swing voters who decide every election. So it's a very interesting dynamic leading into this that could potentially backfire massively. And to me, it seems like a bit of a gamble when you have a majority. Whether or not you're going to maintain that or not, you don't know, right? You don't know. So I guess there's a political gamble there as well, because this election, again, determined by the swing voters, a lot of straight party ticket voters as well, who are going to go in and say, I like this presidential candidate, therefore I'm going to vote a straight ticket. And anyone that comes along with that ticket comes along with that ticket. Now, the other element of interest in all of this which is still too soon to tell, and we're months away from knowing, is what happens if these two most interesting, I believe, candidates in this election so far end up without their party's nomination. And what happens if they do launch an independent run, right? Because then we're not talking about a street ticket. We're talking about an independent candidate. And if they're the ones gaining the momentum, then this could be a gamble that pays off for Senate Republicans who are saying, well, we're going to maintain our dominance. We don't have anything to worry about. Now, I don't know if someone is thinking that ahead. I don't know if Senator Mitch McConnell is thinking, yeah, you know what, that we could see that happen. Anything could happen. We know that. But one thing that could certainly be the unintended consequence of all of this is that there is a distaste of Republicanism because of those who see this type of political wrangling as being a problem. They're the ones in the middle. They could be swayed again in any election, any day. Now, they could vote in two different ways depending on the day they happen to be going into the polls. It's just whichever way the wind blows. Who's got a better hair day that day, right? Whatever. They're going to make a decision based on the popularity of that particular candidate and not necessarily on the issues. However, this now becomes an issue that they might vote against, and that's what... Certainly NPR, I posted this on my Facebook page, npr.org has some of this reflection, Reuters does as well today, and it really comes down to who's energizing the voter. Republicans seem to be with steam in the early election cycles with the primaries and the caucus and things that we've seen so far, but it's still too soon to tell, and especially if we get into a situation where we are painting such a negative picture of Congress and especially the Republican-controlled Senate, that Democrat candidates, Democrat, those who are promoting the Democrat Party, right? It doesn't have to be the candidate. It could be the DNC themselves or anyone who wants to go against the Republicans could easily spin this in a way that makes these decisions look very bad for the country. So... I think that it's a gamble at this point to come out and say something of this nature. We know that the makeup of the Supreme Court could be imbalanced by this, and we know that there are some very important decisions, and as always, there are important decisions. But as I've said before, I think we've been surprised, right? I think we've been surprised by other nominees who appear to be something that they're not. And then there are those who make decisions that surprise the heck out of you. And when you see their decisions and you see what they have ruled on and how they've ruled, and it's just, you never know. So is it worth, I guess that's the question, is it worth the potential backfire to ride this out and play this game? That's one that only time will tell, but it looks like that's the direction we're going. So... maybe it's a good idea, maybe it's not, but there's going to be a lot of finger pointing between here and there. That's pretty much guaranteed. So I found this posted over my Facebook page. Find it interesting that we're getting into the 3D printing is now going to the toy makers as well. And there was a very popular toy back in the day where you could make creepy crawly things, right? I remember this as a kid. And I never had one, but I coveted my friends when I saw them with one because you could pour the stuff in the mold and you would make these creatures, right? Whatever, bugs and the like. Now, the thing maker... apparently, as it was called, is a 3D printer. So not only can you make your own characters, but you do them in a 3D fashion with movable parts, and you can make robots and all kinds of alien creatures and bugs and you name it. And it's not just popping them out of a mold, which that was a 3D creature that would come out of that, but you're actually printing them with a 3D printer. And I was talking about the recent Pinewood Derby, and I don't know how this car qualified because it was a 3D printed car, which was surprising to see. But that's kind of where we are this day and age. How can that's kind of fun to think about just making your own toys. Who cares? We'll do it the way we want to do it. So that's interesting. I started the show talking about this, and this is another one of those modern developments that I think is great in so many ways. And the it's a smart go-kart, right? It's an electric go-kart. So you don't have the big Briggs & Stratton's engine back there, which, you know, kids could never start that thing anyway because it's so hard to pull the crank. You'd have to get your dad to start it up before you drove it. But this has a geofencing capability that allows parents to control where it goes, and you can control, you can put a governor on the speed of this thing on your smartphone. And if you don't want your kids going that fast because you don't want them, it goes up to 12 miles per hour, which is a pretty good zip on a go-kart. But if you want to slow it down until they get the speed down, or you want to restrict where they go, you can do that. It's amazing, right? And for anyone to be afraid of technology or think that, oh, we've gone too far, next thing you know, the robots will be taken over. I would hope that you would embrace this as something really cool, right? I mean, look where this is going. We've got 3D printers for toys. We've got geofencing on electric go-karts. It's still the same stuff we had as kids, only better, only refined, right? The refinement that can come from these type of things, I would hope that we see as something very, very good. I know that there are those who still have some degree of question about the escalation of technology, which I don't necessarily get unless we just want to be sticks in the mud and decide that we don't like to embrace anything that's new. But this is where we are. Undoubtedly, right? This is where things are going, so you may as well just embrace it and hope for the best. Now, at the same time, we got to realize that there, anytime there's opportunity for good, there's opportunity for bad, and vice versa, right? Scripture says where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And that, I think, is the lesson, that even if we see bad stuff or we see questionable or dubious activity, whatever it may be, and there are those, and Father John Ricardo is one who says we have technological advancements because of the porn industry. If it's speed of your internet, or if it's a better screen resolution, it's all porn, which maybe it is, I don't know. But who cares who's behind it when it comes to pushing this? If we embrace this and use it for good, that's what it's about, right? So don't be afraid. Fear not. As Jesus would say, just be responsible. Understand what you're doing. And I think it's incredibly responsible to have an electric go-kart that hopefully you will ride more than your kids, at least in my case. I hope the seat goes back far enough, right? That's my only concern. I just want to make sure that I could fit on the thing without major modifications. Exciting stuff. Hey, follow me over on Facebook, Leo C. Brown. You'll find this story posted and all of the many things that we've talked about this afternoon over there. Feel free to comment and share as well. We'll be back tomorrow afternoon for the Leo Brown Almost Hour. Thank you for listening, and God bless.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.